The adjectives being used to describe Lincoln Center Theater's new staging of Clifford Odets' 1937 boxing drama, Golden Boy, impeccable, majestic, and dazzling, might seem like hyperbole, at least until you see the production, which John Lahr, the New Yorker's drama critic, calls one of the best displays of American ensemble acting I've seen. It's currently at the Belasco Theater, the same theater where it first ran in 1937, and I'm very pleased to welcome its director, Bartlett Sher, back to our show, along with cast members Tony Shalhoub and Seth Numrich. Welcome. And is it okay if I call you Bart?
Yeah, absolutely.
At least one reviewer calls Golden Boy Odette's masterpiece. Was it seen that way when it first opened?
Actually, it was a big success when it first opened. When he did it, he wanted to make sure that he was asked by Harold Klerman to write a hit for the group theater, who were sort of struggling at the time and needed the money. And he was living in Hollywood and being paid like $5,000 a week, and actually came back to New York and put in the time and wrote it. And it turned into be a giant success for them.
But Awake and Sing, which you directed for Lincoln Center a few years ago, has often been described as his best play. Is it even fair to rank them?
It's interesting. I think emotionally, Awake and Sing is very different in where it hits you in the heart than something like Golden Boy, because it's all set around a Jewish family in the Bronx and around the loss of the grandfather. And it has ultimately a somewhat more hopeful, slightly younger approach. So I think it's a little bit like when people say, oh, I really liked your early work so much better.
It's also a little more political.
Yeah, well, it's more hopeful in its politics. This one's politics are much more complicated around the idea of success. It's the same theme, strangely. What is the issue of success in your life, and what does a real success mean, and what do you want for your future? But it does get definitely more complicated as Odette gets older.
Now, Seth, you're coming to this from War Horse. Do you miss the puppets at all?
I'll always have a special place in my heart for the puppets and everyone at War Horse. It was a great experience. But the great thing about doing this play is we get to rehearse at Lincoln Center underneath the Beaumont, so I get to see all the War Horse people every day. But, you know, doing something like this, you kind of couldn't get two more different plays than War Horse and Golden Boy. So getting to go from something like that to something like this, I feel like I've learned so much and grown from doing both. It's been amazing.
You play Joe Bonaparte, the Golden Boy of the title, who gives up a promising career as a violinist to pursue fame and fortune in the boxing ring. Did you ever box before you took this role?
No, my only experience was when I was preparing for the audition. I was actually in Los Angeles spending some time out there, and I knew I was flying back to New York to audition for Bart, and I took a few lessons, boxing lessons, at a small gym out in Los Angeles, just to try and start to feel like what the body of a boxer might feel like. And, you know, after that, I got really excited about it. I really enjoyed it. And so throughout the preparation before rehearsals and then throughout rehearsals and now still as we're running, I've continued to train in the boxing movement and all that stuff.
So there's still boxing gyms in the New York area?
Yeah, there are a few. There are a few really good ones. And there aren't as many nearly as there were in the 1930s. It was a much bigger sport and more prominent at that time. So you could find a boxing gym about on every other corner. But now today it's less popular. But
Gleason's.
There's still Gleason's Gym. There's Church Street Boxing downtown. There are a few still left.
Now, Tony, you have become, even though you have had a distinguished career, you've become a household name as the TV detective Adrian Monk. Here you play Joe's Italian immigrant father, identified only as Mr. Bonaparte. Is that because he's from the old country and has that European formality?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure why Odette's chose not to give this character a first name, but I think there is a certain amount of he's either referred to as Papa by his children, or Mr. Bonaparte, and in a sense I think that's appropriate because you know a lot of these immigrants wanted to feel that they, you know, that they were respected, and you know they tried to speak well and carry themselves well. I certainly remember that from growing up, and my father was an immigrant from Lebanon, and that generation and the generation before him, there were, often wore ties, and even when they were out working in the garden.
Well, he's the moral conscience of this play as much as anyone, and it probably would come as a surprise to people who see it to learn that Odette's had a very bad relationship with his father, because your character is one we really respect.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think, in a sense, there was maybe an attempt on Odette's part to kind of reconcile all of the conflicts he had with his father, and maybe to write a more kind of idealized figure.
You're the father he wished he had?
Or in some ways, but also, I think that's true. And also that there's a certain, it's almost that even though this character of the father is the moral center of the play, there's also there's a bit of a naivete about him, a kind of an old world innocence, you might say, about him. And he comes to, I think, in the course of the play, realize that, actually there is a lot of darkness and things to be feared in this world, but he continues to pull himself up by the bootstraps.
Well, he's not a bully like Odette's father. You performed the role with a heavy Italian accent. Was that written into the script?
It is, actually. It's written it's
very heavily into the script.
It's almost too heavy.
It puts a lot of us at the end of words.
Yeah, and then we added some real Italian to kind of give it some measure, because in some ways it's kind of like very stereotype pizza pie paisan Italian, and we kind of had to try to make it a little bit more human sounding, because it was a very awkward dialect that was written in.
Because Odette could have written this as a Jewish character as well.
There's a lot of questions as to why he made him Italian in the Lower East Side, and
did Luther Adler play him?
No, Morris Karnofsky.
Played the father. Golden Boy?
Yeah, Luther Adler.
So we're talking about a lot of Jewish actors playing Italians.
Playing Italians, yeah. I had a lot of Italians playing Jewish actors in Awaken Sing, so I guess it might be sort of fair. I don't really know why, but I mean, I think that he didn't distinguish the immigrant experience entirely based on exactly where you came from, and he was trying to respond to a Lower East Side world, whereas he was more of a Bronx Jew. So I don't know if that's it. And his own relationship to his father, I think, as much as he was his bully, his father also had a huge impact on driving him to become who he became, and really pushed him in a lot of ways.
To become an artist.
Yeah, to become an artist and to stay with certain ideals. So as much as his father was also impossible, he did push him in really profound and powerful ways. So,
My guests are Bartlett Scherr, who is the director of a new production of Golden Boy, now at the Belasco, and Tony Shalhoub, who plays the father of the Golden Boys, Seth Nemrich, who plays the Golden Boy himself. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Was one of the reasons for doing this play now that this year marks the 75th anniversary of its first production in 1937?
Not the primary reason. I mean, we wanted to do it not long after we originally did Awake and Sing, but never found quite the right opportunity. And finally, Andre Bishop at Lincoln Center pushed me and said, the 75th anniversary is coming up. I think we should look at Golden Boy again. And we started the casting process. It was still a little bit based on making sure we could find people who could actually do it.
Well, according to Wikipedia, the last time it was revived in New York City was 1952.
Yes.
Do you think it hasn't been done more often because it requires such a huge cast, 19 actors?
I do think that has an impact on it. I also think it's a three-act play. It's longer. It's a bit more demanding. The subject matter is tough. And the ending is essentially like a kind of tragedy. So all of those things together, what you don't remember about it is how full of life it is and how great the actors are and all those other things. But yeah, I do think that had an impact.
Well, it lasts 3 hours, but I was thinking afterward, what would I have cut? Now, I've often left movies and thought, oh, I could have cut out that scene. I could have cut out something else. This is pretty tightly written. Is it just a coincidence that it's at the Belasco Theater, the same theater where it was produced in 1937?
Well, when we did Awake and Sing, which was also at the Belasco, we tried to be at the Belasco, and in this case, we sort of were hoping at the same time to be in the same situation. But I'm a big believer in whenever you get a chance, especially as an American theater artist, to be able to be a part of your own history is a kind of blessing and a rare opportunity. So the fact that Lincoln Center and the Schubert Organization knew that we had this relationship, we knew this was a special place for it. We did try to be able to work there. And I love the Belasco. It's such a beautiful theater, and it seemed like the best place. And I think space can teach you things about the piece you're doing, and that seemed to be the case here.
Now, Tony, we mentioned that Italian has actually been added to this. You've become a kind of an expert in doing Italian. Do you speak any Italian?
I aspire to be an expert.
You spoke Italian at Big Night.
I have over the years taken Italian, and I'm now currently taking Italian again. It's just a language I keep gravitating to, and seems like roles that I keep gravitating to. But again, this is really more about the immigrant experience. So this role, this acting challenge, and that's something that just fascinates me and is in my DNA.
Seth, in the opening scene of the play, your character Joe bursts into a fight manager's office with the news that his best fighter has been injured, and then he offers to take his place in an upcoming fight. What's the manager's reaction to that?
Well, it changes over the course of the scene, but you know the obvious reaction is, you know, who the heck is this kid, and who does he think he is coming into my office? I mean, it's a sort of ludicrous idea, and you know, as in rehearsal, equating it to my own experience, it would be like, you know, hearing that Daniel Radcliffe is sick and running over to How to Succeed in Business last year and saying, "Hey, listen, I can do it." You know, so it's a little bit crazy, but it also, you know, gives the audience the opportunity to be introduced to this character, Joe Bonaparte, someone who has a lot of guts and who also, I think, sees himself in a desperate situation, you know, growing up in the conditions that he is growing up in. And he sees an opportunity and he does everything within his power to try to grasp that opportunity to better himself in his mind and find a leg up in the world. So that's when I think of what I think about backstage before I run on into that scene, that idea of this is it. This is my chance to get somewhere and to be somebody, and so that's what I try to bring in the door every night.
And the manager, Tom Dowd,
Tom Moody.
Moody, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Tom Moody makes fun of the fact that Joe is cross-eyed, as he says, cockeyed.
Yeah.
How do you, I mean, do you do anything with your eyes to suggest that you're cross-eyed?
I do. It was a discussion throughout rehearsal of how we would deal with that. It was important to me that there was some element, you know, visually and physically of Joe being somewhat deformed in that way because it's such a big element in the play. And we talked about having contact lenses that would, you know, offset one of my eyes a little bit, but decided that, you know, the two people per night that would actually see that from the audience didn't quite make it worth it. So what
the other cast members would see it.
Yeah, that was part of, honestly,
Strasberg would have appreciated that. Yeah.
I mean, it was part of why I wanted to have something so that the other actors something to play off of. So what I do now is significantly less high tech. I just hold one of my eyes slightly closed for the duration.
The rest of the cast is still amazed at how he can do that over the course of 2 hours.
And there's some talk of makeup, too. It just sort of like.
Yeah, we had thought about that, some kind of prosthetic, but it didn't end up working. So I just hold my eye.
Well, I wonder why Odette's even thought of that. It wouldn't help a boxer to be cross-eyed. If anything, it might hurt.
Yeah, no, that's the whole thing. I think it's that it would make it less likely he'd be any good. Yeah,
and I think it also has to do with how it's affected Joe's childhood and his upbringing. And I mean, he's already an Italian, son of an Italian immigrant, living in poverty, basically. But then adding on to that, a reason why he's been made fun of and looked down upon and looked on as stupid and ignorant for his entire life. I think that just adds to Joe's building rage and his reason to try to lash out and get back at the world and get somewhere in his life.
Although there are two female characters, Tom Moody's mistress, Lorna Moon, played by an Australian actress, Yvonne Strahovski, although you'd never know. This is her Broadway debut? Where
yes,
did you
she's
find
actually
her?
Never even seen a Broadway play.
How
she's
did you
only
find
been
her?
In them. We found her in Los Angeles. We were auditioning all over. It was very hard to find, and she came in, and we did a couple of auditions out there, and she has a very special elegance and physicality and incredibly, or she's never actually worked in her own dialect. She only has done shows in American English and now New Jersey. She's pretty. She mispronounced Triborough at the first reading.
That was very little adorable.
We're all a little embarrassed. So,
but this is very much a male-dominated play and dominated cast because it's about boxing.
Yeah, it's a masculine world. There's no question. And boxing is a very incredibly interesting American metaphor and reality. In terms of our violent nature, in terms of strategy, in terms of ambition, in terms of pushing ahead. And it was something which...
Even though it is a masculine play, though, the character of Lorna is kind of what drives so much of the action, conflict, and complexity.
Well, it's a love triangle on top of everything.
Exactly.
Else.
But even Joe, you know, and he's drawn to her. Her rejection of him drives him further. And none of what happens in the play would happen if it weren't for that female.
There's
character.
Also the female element that's missing in the play, which is Joe's mother, which is rarely, if ever, referred to other than Joe revealing to Lorna that she died when he was at a young age. But I think that has a huge significance in the play, that because Joe doesn't have a mother figure is part of what drives him towards Lorna and also part of what's driving him in general throughout the play. So,
this was a time, the late 30s, when boxing was a major sport in America. Joe Louis fighting the German champion becomes a world event.
Yeah, and boxing... Boxing exploded from the 30s all the way into the 50s, especially, and even into the 60s. It's still big, but it's not quite the same. It's not like any other sport, because we actually went to some boxing matches, and, I've watched boxing all my life, not as a huge enthusiast, but a Muhammad Ali fan, the normal kind of growing up. And it's probably surprising how... both thrilling and exciting and brutal it is at the same time. You know, the experience of actual seeing so much blood and seeing people take that kind of risk with their bodies and their minds and their well-being in sport is not like other things where you go as far. And it was a healthy thing to focus the cast learning on. We had a lot of people come in and talk to us and sort of learn a lot about the sport. It was great.
My guests are Bartlett Scher, director of a new production of Golden Boy, the first since 1964, I guess, 65, when Sammy Davis Jr. played Golden Boy, now played by Seth Nemrich with a very different script. Tony Shalhoub as his father. It's at the Belasco Theater, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Bartlett Scher, who is the director of, this is your second Odette's play?
My second, yeah.
This one is Golden Boy, back on Broadway for the first time since 1952. And also with us are Seth Nemrich, who plays the Golden Boy, Tony Shalhoub, who plays his father, Odette's, as you mentioned earlier, was a member of the legendary group theater. The original cast for Golden Boy included Lee J. Cobb, Ilya Kazan, Harry Morgan, Howard DeSilva, Carl Malden, John Garfield, Morris Karnofsky. Who else?
Phoebe Brand, Francis Farmer. It was extraordinary.
Luther Adler. Francis Farmer was one of Odette's, the women in Odette's life.
Yeah, for a while. I mean, he tortured her a bit. You know? I mean, it was just an amazing group. I mean, the group theater itself was one of those rare times when you had both an approach to acting and a great writer at the center and a kind of political point of view all wrapped up into the same collective. And, they were a spirited, powerful group of people. And there was always a lot of struggle in that particular production because Garfield had wanted to play the Golden Boy and Odette's wanted him to. Harold Klerman, who was the director and leader of the group theater with Strasberg, felt it should be Luther Adler, and it ended up being Luther Adler. And it was an interesting choice.
Now, this is less political than the previous plays. He, Odets, wrote it after he had worked in Hollywood, as you said. And you don't see much of his politics in the Hollywood scripts. The General Died at Dawn, None But the Lonely Heart, Humoresque, Deadline at Dawn, Sweet Smell of Success, which many people will remember, Wild in the Country. And then I gather he wrote some uncredited scripts for a number of films, or at least scenes. It's a Wonderful Life and Notorious. That's amazing range.
Yeah. I would say it's not political with a, you know, capital P, but I do think it's political. I do think his politics are kind of always permeate all the way through. But it's not, you know, in this case, it's really about what values should guide a society, the values of culture and art and ideas, or the values of ambition and success and capitalism and, you know, achievement.
Well, did that grow out of his own conflict there? He goes to Hollywood and starts making a lot of money and actually has to adjust his ideas.
I think he's one of those early versions of an artist, which is more common to us now, who wanted to pursue very high ideals as an artist and then ran into the sort of buzzsaw of fame and money and success and women and all, and was struggling very honestly with how to put those two things together. It actually kind of destroyed him, that problem. He couldn't always handle his own success. And there's some weird way in which, as early as this one in his career, it's kind of openly grappling with his own future.
But Joe Bonaparte is very talented as a violinist, but he definitely prefers the fame, the glory, the wealth, the girl that boxing will bring him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, for Joe, those are the two forces that are pulling on him throughout the play. And I think that it, you know, it speaks something to the difference of, you know, the way that his father may have grown up and the values that were instilled in him in Italy and coming to the United States, and that immigrant experience versus being the next generation and feeling a pressure to move up in the world, and that, you know, suddenly being in the American environment where, you know, the American dream and the idea of bettering yourself through, you know, fortune and success and fame and those things, I think he feels an immense amount of pressure that's probably he's putting on himself more than his father might be putting on him, but that he feels from the society around him. And those are the forces that are driving him towards, you know, thinking that he wants those things more than the other, and then not realizing until maybe it's too late that he might have been wrong.
And it's more than symbolic that boxing will destroy his hands for violin
right.
playing.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that Odets chooses to make the choice, you know, be between two things that are physically impossible to coexist, that you cannot be a violinist and a boxer at the same time. And, you know, I wonder...
You can be a Hollywood hack and a great Broadway playwright at the same time.
Yes, you could. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I mean, I think...
We've seen it.
I think that it is possible, you know, artistically, and it's, I think, what we all strive for is to remain grounded in your artistic integrity and also be able to, you know, make a living and have a family and support yourself and be successful in those ways. So, I mean, hopefully we all want to believe that it is possible. And you know, you wonder if Odets ever, you know, found an end to that struggle within himself.
Well, Tony, you talked before about one of the themes being about immigrants adjusting to America, assimilating. Another theme is taxis. He had a couple of plays with taxis in them.
Yes.
That's part, I guess, even today, isn't that part of immigrant adjustment?
I don't know. I don't know specifically.
Well, it's hard to find a New York cab driver who hasn't come from some other place.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's never more true than today, right?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's – I'm wondering if Odets actually drove a cab at some point.
Yeah, I think it's possible.
I mean – as all of us, as actors and people in the in creative pursuits, always had to do those kinds of jobs that, you know, day jobs when we couldn't do the things we love to do. So I think maybe the taxi is just a symbol for all of those less desirable jobs.
Now, this physical production is quite beautiful. Did you get to see the drawings and designs for the original production?
Yes, we have the drawings. It was a very famous designer named Mordecai Gorelick who's written a beautiful book. Also has a beautiful book he's written about design. There's a 1936 or 7 audio recording of the original production you can listen to. And one of the interesting qualities, aside from how fast they actually talk, which is so much faster than I don't even know how they do it, but we try to emulate them.
And audiences got it all at that
day. You can't believe how much they're laughing and how quick the audiences are in terms of their ability to be on top of it. But what's also weird is that in between scenes, you hear this enormous, horrible sound as they're cranking whatever version of the set is. And there's no music holding it together, no nothing. You just hear scene ends and then crank, 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 bump, 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 noise, 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 noise for quite a long period of time, and then the next scene starts, and that's interesting. I mean, you can't transport yourself back to a theater in 1936, but how much we take for granted now of how audiences are taken care of in transition and things like that. But they did have we had all of that. We looked at that very carefully. It was pretty complicated and awkward. It's 8 separate locations, so it makes it more difficult than just, say, a turntable or something like that. And we had to go through a lot to figure that out.
Well, the sets, the lighting and costumes do a great job of evoking New York in the 1930s. And there are actually things in the play, on the set, that work. For example, showers work.
Yes, the shower works. And
that was important.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, it sets up a person who won't take a shower as a joke later on. And so it felt important that we had to have showers there to not follow. And also, that scene in the locker room, you know, should feel a little bit like a slaughterhouse in a weird way. And you wanted the sense of, like, you know, active things like blood and water and stuff like that in the space. So,
although they're dealt with quite casually.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole point of really good naturalism. It's a part of everyday life, and you notice it.
And then you also, I mean, when I think in what's beautiful about seeing Mr. Bonaparte in those scenes is you get to somewhat see that world through his eyes, that everyone else in that space is comfortable with the mm-hmm. brutality and the violence that's you know, surrounding it. And then seeing someone like Mr. Bonaparte in that environment, it gives you more of a sense of how alien this really is to someone who is...
Tony, you have to look like you just dropped in to Mars.
Exactly. It makes him very uncomfortable. I'm imagining what this room smells like, you know, must smell like, and sort of the dank... Kind of, it feels like it's way in a basement. So, you know, the fights and everything are... the arena is upstairs. So you get this sense that it's just very, very depressing. And this is the son, this is the world that his son is, you know, trying to get in and stay in. And it's horrifying.
You mentioned earlier that your character is the kind of man who would have worn a tie even when he was working in the garden. How important are the costumes? They're designed by Catherine Zuber. Do they help characters, actors get into their characters?
Absolutely. The fit of the clothes, the way the shoes feel, the sort of what Catherine's done so beautifully, this sort of layered look. So I have these kind of horsehair undershirts with like sweater vests and then robe over and pants that are high waisted with suspenders, and all of these elements change the way you move, change the way you feel. It really helps to create this to transport you to this other world.
Yeah, I think it's hard to underestimate how completely intimate the relationship between costume and acting is in huge ways. And, you know, just the wide-brimmed hats on these, they're just extra
Everybody
wide.
Has a hat.
Yeah, they're extra wide, and how you have to integrate them in as early as possible so people just have that familiarity of wearing hats in a way we don't now.
And the hats get dropped all over the stage.
All over the place.
Because
you never know where to put them. Well, I won't let anybody put a hat on a table because having done Joe Turner come and gone, it's a huge superstition, so they have to throw them on the floor.
Well, Seth, your costumes change throughout the play,
yeah.
Suggesting the changes in your situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's another great, you know, example of the collaboration between actor and costume designer and director, is how to create that feeling of a progression for a character throughout the play. And for Joe, going from a much more boyish look and a look that is of a lower class, and then throughout the play as he's aspiring to be wealthier and more famous, you see him, you know, kind of growing into that style.
Just one more thing. Wasn't Odette's use of street language considered daring when he first wrote the play? How do you think that the dialogue holds up?
I'm not sure. I was wondering about this question. Bart was saying earlier how when we were listening to this recording of the original production, again, they were speeding through this dialogue, and the audience was just, it was as if they were watching a Neil Simon comedy. They must have, their ears were much more attuned, I guess, to the language of that.
But people laugh at the lines here as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we get lots of laughs, but there it was kind of like, it was funhouse sort of laughter. It was so constant. And but they were just, their ears were tuned to that language. Obviously, he was writing in his present day. But I think it holds up really well. Once the audience in the first 30 seconds or 60 seconds makes the adjustment to this period language, they get on that train and they're just with us.
Well, how is it for the actors?
It's fantastic. We have this gritty language that's also poetic, at the same time very poetic, and lines that feel so unexpected and unpredictable, and yet couldn't be more perfect coming out of these characters.
Now, Bart, have you looked at some of the later plays, like Country Girl?
Yeah.
Is his dialogue as natural as it is here? Because it's both poetic and kind of streetwise.
Yeah, talking to his son, Walt, you know, he said that's how he talked every day. He was that kind of, he had a kind of ear. I do think the only way that language really does make total sense is if you completely approach it from a kind of truthfulness, and then lift up into the poetry. And that's where you have to have actors, where I'm lucky enough to have actors as skilled as this, who can like dig into the truth and yet have the verbal skills to also keep lifting and moving through the language. That's where it, like any great American artist or great playwright, you want them to challenge you to speak at a really great level. So
Bart LeCher is the director of this new production of Golden Boy, unfortunately with a limited run until
the 20th?
January 20th.
Yeah.
And Tony Shalhoub and Seth Numerick are two of its stars. And I thank you all so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.